Senator Jan is just coming, so if anybody has any particular questions you can ask today, or we'll just listen to him. There was a question about the practice using metta meditation, the meditation on loving kindness. This practitioner, their aim is to attain Sotapanna. So they're asking, can we do this through the practice of metta meditation alone, as explained by the Buddha in the Metta Sutta, or do we have to contemplate other dhammas such as the Paticchasamubbada and the Four Noble Truths and so on? Satanajan explained that metta bhavana is one of the 40 main meditation objects we use to develop states of calm, peace, samadhi. So it's what we call a samatha meditation object. Just we use that for calming the mind. Once the mind is peaceful, though, we do have to develop insight, wisdom, by contemplating this body and mind, as the Buddha called it. We talk about the body and mind as the five khandhas: form, feeling, memory, thought formations, and sense consciousness. These five khandhas that make up a human being. We have to contemplate them with our peaceful mind, with mindfulness and samadhi, till we see the impermanent nature of these five khandhas, see that they're unsatisfactory because they're impermanent, they're temporary, and they're ultimately without a self, a fixed self, without an owner. So we say that anicca, dukkha, anatta. This kind of insight is what will cut off the first three fetters, what one is required to do to attain Sotapanna. One has to see through this, the view, change one's view of this body and see that this body is actually impermanent, it's not self, and cut off the fetter of the attachment to rituals and external practices, and then the fetter of doubt, skeptical doubt, uncertainty. These are what Sotapanna has managed to abandon. That can only come through contemplation, using insight to develop wisdom, true, clear understanding of the way things are. The metta meditation is suitable for anyone, particularly those with a lot of anger in your character. If you have that characteristic comes up a lot in your life, then any of the four Brahma Viharas are suitable for that practitioner. So these Brahma Viharas, we call them the divine abidings, the kindness, loving kindness meditation, compassion meditation, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These four different meditation topics are all suitable, particularly for somebody who has a lot of anger. Anyone else have any other questions? Yeah.
My mother's getting older, and soon she'll be dead. Maybe not in 20 years, but soon enough. I was wondering, how do I best introduce her to Dharma and Buddhism and stuff? She's kind of Christian. Not seriously Christian, and she's a very good one. She's got better sila than me. I just wondered, how do I bring her some merit?
Well, you can teach her what you know about the Buddhist teachings. You don't have to call it Buddhism, like, you know, in temples and Buddhist places we have a lot of statues and rituals and so on. You don't have to start there. The starting point may be the Buddha stands for enlightenment knowledge, the enlightened mind, the mind that has seen, the mind that is purified and experienced emptiness from attachment and suffering. So you start, that's the starting point of Buddhism. So you don't have to call it the Buddha, and you don't have to have statues or anything like that. You start from the point of the mind that is pure and wise. And then the path that the Buddha taught is a gradual path, and you'll find particularly the initial stages of practice are nothing strange. You know, it's, you'll find it in Christianity, in any culture. We're taught to try and practice kindness, generosity, charity, and so on, as a beginning, as a sort of foundation for our life. You'll probably find that anywhere in the world, so that shouldn't be anything unusual, so to encourage her in that. But then it's a gradual training, say, from that foundation to go on and say, well, Mum, is your mind peaceful or not? You know, in daily life, do you have any stress? Do you have any times when the mind feels disturbed, unhappy? And she'll probably say, well, yes, sometimes there are. So then, what can we do about that? That's where meditation comes in. And again, you introduce meditation techniques without having to say, well, this is the Buddhist teaching and so you have to be Buddhist to do this. You can just introduce it as a way to make the mind peaceful. So things like the breath meditation, loving kindness meditation, these various techniques that you've learnt about, encourage your mum to try them as a way to find more inner peace in her mind in daily life. If she's doing that and she's finding that she is getting some more peace, well then the next step of this gradual training, path of training, is to consider more deeply, get her to consider, well, what is the real cause of suffering in life? When I have stress and suffering, where does it come from? And this is the development of wisdom. So when she's experiencing more states of calm, then to investigate, well, what's the cause of suffering? To see, well, it's attachment. We attach to this body, we attach to the things of this world, our loved ones, our possessions. Even on a more subtle level, we attach to every thought and desire and mood that we experience. So then to see, well, how do we deal with this attachment then, so that to free ourselves from the various stress and suffering it causes? Well, notice how all the things we attach to are impermanent. They're subject to change. They're beyond our control. We can't make things be a certain way or hold on to them or control them. So this is what we call not self. So you're getting her to use the peaceful mind to reflect more deeply on truth, of the truth of our existence, which will bring her to that emptiness that the Buddha represents. And all of that, one can, you know, encourage one's parents to do that without necessarily saying, well, you have to be Buddhist or you have to go to a temple or anything like that. One introduces it as just a good way to live, to find peace, and then to find understanding from that peace. Three dynasties. Yeah, there's a question about the practice of vipassana. What really constitutes vipassana? What is real vipassana, or what is just thinking? Because we hear a lot about this in Buddhist circles. And Tan says, well, if he meditates and makes his mind calm, and then he starts thinking about the three dynasties, you know, the Chinese history, these three dynasties that are always fighting and arising and getting powerful and then losing the battles and fading away and disappearing, contemplating impermanence, you know, the rise and fall of kingdoms and individuals in those kingdoms and so on. Is this vipassana? So Ajahn says, well, it can be the beginning of vipassana. You can take anything in this world and contemplate it. You know, when you're calm, you just turn your attention to think about, it can be external things. So it could be a kingdom in history, or it could be anything you have in this world, you know, a city or a mountain or a person. Everything is impermanent. So when you turn your mind just to contemplate that, what you do then next is bring that contemplation back to compare and look at your own experience more closely in the present. So you're saying, well, just as people in history have been born, lived their lives, had power, had success or failures, and then died, well, so too my life. I have been born, I live in this world for a while, I have some success, some failures, whatever, and then I'll die just in that same way. So you're bringing that reflection into your own heart, and you know, you can start with externals like this. You can contemplate your home or your job or the economy or the business you do. You can contemplate your body, the health of your body, the aging of your body. And you can bring it right back to the point where you're just saying, well, even just my own thoughts and moods and feelings are also just arising, passing away, they're impermanent. They're all vehicles for developing insight. And insight means clear vision of the way things are, clear seeing of the way things are. So if that vehicle works to bring you to see the impermanent nature of your own body, your own mind, the world around you, well, then that's a valid way to practice. And it does start like that. Often we just think of certain things, we're thinking about something, but using Dhamma as a way of reflecting, and then gradually that comes back to our own heart, the heart quietens down, and we're just seeing everything from then on, oh, yeah, it's all impermanent.
Maybe do the chanting, say in Pali, because I don't understand the language. Do I concentrate on the sound, the spelling, the meaning of the word at that time of chanting? Or should I just focus my mind on the various syllables and chant? And if they chant for the departed ones, do the departed ones really understand?
That if you're chanting, if you don't know the meaning of the words that are being chanted, you haven't learned that yet, just focus on the sound. So if you're chanting, or the sounds you're making and make, you know, chanting the correct words at the correct moment, make that the object of your mindfulness. So it's the sound and the sound of the words. If you do know the meaning, you can contemplate that, but if you don't, just go with the sound. Say, when we're chanting for the dead, we have a funeral or a ceremony for the dead, making merit for the dead. The chanting is actually for the living, for us. Those words have good meaning. We benefit, we become clearer in our mind, maybe gives rise to mindfulness, understanding at that time. The dead people won't hear those chants, so it's for us.
Asians, they go to the cemetery and offer food to the dead, to the government. And after that, shoot the food. After offering food, the departed ones may be haircuts. Should the food be given to the humans to eat? Because after the potatoes may have tasted it, if they really taste it, I'm not sure. But whether
right. Really, if you're giving it as an offering to ghosts, as inviting ghosts to come and eat this food, that's the end of it. You shouldn't think about going off and eating it for yourself or give it to others. You just say, oh, well, this food, we'll leave it here for spirits of the ancestors, and just that's good enough. You don't have to eat it after that or give it to anyone else. Whether they're what? But that's your intention, isn't it? You're putting it there for spirits. So he said, that's your intention for that food, so then you shouldn't be giving it to anyone else. Whether spirits come or not, it doesn't matter, but that's your intention. Usually, if it's our relatives, they've been buried there for a while. Their spirit won't be there anymore. They've been, assuming they've got some merit, they've gone off and been born either in heaven or as a human. But whether other ghostly spirits come by and say, "Oh, food given to ghosts, I can have this," or that, you might have that happen. But probably your relatives already been long since they've been born somewhere else. They're not there anymore. Just a question, if we make food offerings to the monks, once the monks have accepted them, say return them to the kitchen, are we allowed to eat? Yes, we can, because the monks share them with the laity. Once it's been offered to the monks, they've taken what they want, then they send it back, then lay people can eat those food offerings. Oh, making food offerings to the Buddha statue, placing. Once that ceremony is over, you can take it away and eat. Yes, you can. In the same way as live monks, you can eat the food left from live monks. You can also eat the food left from the Buddha statue.
Ajahn Anand was meditating at the peak where the Buddha footprints was. Ajahn had vision of the Devatade, and was there any conversation taking place in the vision?
What happens? We went up. We invited the devas to come and listen to the chanting, the paritta chanting, and then the sangha chanted the parittas. So it's recollecting the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the sangha, and the teachings of the Buddha. And Ajahn invited all the devas to come and listen. So many, many, many devas came. The whole sky was filled with devas because it's a very special place because of that Buddha's footprint. And he invited the barami of the Buddha to come to, on that occasion, to bless that occasion. So there was as if the rainbow light of aura of the Buddha came as well. But there was no conversation, you know, talking to the devas, just invited them to come and share in the merit of that occasion, listening to the chanting. The Bodhisattva came as well at that time, and what everyone saw, not just those with psychic powers, everyone could see this huge white cloud. It was a blue sky day. We were on top of this mountain, it was just blue sky all around, but there's this huge white cloud started to form around the very peak of this mountain. The mountain is pyramid shape. Around the very peak, this huge white cloud formed in the shape of a dragon, curling around, and the head came right up to where we were sitting. So everybody is saying, oh, this is a special cloud, we call it a dragon cloud. And some of the group were at the foot of the mountain because they couldn't walk up. They looked up and they could take they took pictures as well, and they could see this dragon wrapping around where we were up on top. This is one of his trip to China last month. This is China, Puto-san.
And you don't
need. You're called Natty by my pin.
Don't tell Natty by
my name. This is the Bodhisattva image at Puto-san Temple. This is 4:18 in the afternoon. That's the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin. This is like 1 second later, the next photo. The image is starting to get a little bit brighter. That's the next photo, so that's one photo on.
That's not a statue?
That's a statue, but they're taking a photo of it. That's the third photo in 1 second. That was 1 second later. The whole image disappeared into bright white light. Normally you should be seeing that statue at that moment, but you just get the white light.
The
the person taking the photos saw this phenomena happening, so Ajahn said, oh, just keep taking photos, keep clicking the shutter. So they got a series of photos. The statue disappearing into white light, pure light, symbolizes the pure mind, the mind that sees emptiness, the emptiness of all phenomena in nature, physical, mental phenomena, empty of self. It's the pure mind, so it symbolizes that. Fifth trip. It's been there quite a few times over the last years. Six times it's been. They are in Thailand at his temple. He didn't bring them this time. The causes of this picture are partly. The monks who were present, and then the person taking the picture, their faith, and then the bodhisattva itself, all these causes came together to give this result. It's the biggest one. In that area, it's the biggest temple. Built by the emperor about 300 years ago. There's a high probability, yes. Says in China, going on these trips, he's been looking at how Buddhism has survived there, and actually the faith of the people is still very strong. Obviously the government doesn't allow many activities, doesn't really allow teaching of Buddhism or monks to go around teaching, so he says that people have a lot of faith, just like in Thailand, say on Chinese New Year, everyone closes up their business and they go to temples and make offerings. In China it's the same, they like to travel out and make offerings, donations, go to these pilgrimage sites. So there's many, many people there who still have strong faith in Buddhism, but what's lacking is monks to teach them how to practice. There's not much teaching going on because the government doesn't support that. They actually have many regulations limiting what monks can teach. So at the moment that's the sort of state of Buddhism in China. So if you compare our lives here in this country, we actually have the good fortune we can go to temples, we can practice meditation, we can listen to Dhamma, we can invite teachers to teach, we can go on retreats, all of these activities which we might take for granted. They're severely limited in China, so we actually have a much better opportunity to practice here. So that's something to appreciate, you know, the good opportunity you do have here and in many other countries to practice Dhamma.